Hi, I'm Bill Kristol. Welcome back to Conversations. I'm very pleased to be joined today by Royal Hansen, Vice President of Security at Google, someone who's worked at high levels on the issue of cybersecurity at many financial services firms and tech firms, and has given this a lot of thought, briefed people on the Hill and journalists, as well as obviously working with his peers in the area on this, on all the interesting questions, many of the interesting questions, at least, raised by the real challenges of cybersecurity. And I look forward to getting educated on that today, and I'm sure our audience does as well. So Royal, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Look forward to it.
That's really, I really appreciate it. I know you're a busy person, so I really appreciate you taking the time. So cybersecurity, the name just gets thrown around a lot, and what is it, or what are the threats that we're worried about, and how serious are they? And give a little bit of a brief briefing on this for those of us who aren't in the middle of that world.
No, it's a good starting point, because that word has come to mean a lot of different things to people. I like to think of it in two ways. The first is cybersecurity is relevant anywhere you've had technological or data-driven innovation over the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So instead of thinking of cybersecurity as, you know, some like maybe air or land or sea, this is that anywhere there's technology that's changed the way we do work, changed the way we live our lives, changed the conveniences. Think of all the conveniences that have sort of been brought to bear on the last couple decades. Cybersecurity is the safety, sort of reliability, availability of that technology. So that's sort of the one area, is to think really it follows the innovations. Anywhere we've innovated, invested, changed. The second part, and there's a sort of simple acronym people use, this, you know, CIA, confidentiality, integrity, and availability. So oftentimes we get focused on the confidentiality, right? You read about a breach. It's most of what we do, and someone stealing information. But really, that's just the sort of first step of safety in the broadest sense. We need availability. If these things aren't available, and an outage from a major platform is a huge deal these days. And then integrity, the even more subtle dimension, is do we have confidence in the data, in the technology that we're relying on for all those conveniences? So put in together, everywhere those innovations occur, confidentiality, integrity, and availability, it's almost like quality, you could say, right? Is this doing what I expect and not being abused or misused for other reasons? That's how I think about cybersecurity.
No, that's great. That's very helpful. And so I think what we'll focus on today, this is less maybe individuals, you know, the security of individuals' credit cards, which is not unimportant, or businesses who presumably can to some degree watch out for themselves and are doing so. And they will touch on these, of course. But really, for me, having been in government and here in Washington in politics, it's the political side. I mean, so what is the big picture kind of cybersecurity of the United States, if you want to put it this way, the way we think of our security in terms of the seas and the air and space and, of course, land security? So say a word, I guess, about that, because all these other parts are important too, and it's all, I suppose, related. But how much is it the same challenge that the U.S. faces, that I, Bill Kristol, face, that, you know, someone could be stealing my identity or using my credit card or reading my emails? And how much is it just a whole different thing?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and probably has multiple layers to it, and maybe even to, as we think about it, it's important to think of the data and technology that underpin a society in a world where every industry is modernizing, right? Healthcare, financial services. I mean, the reason I started in financial services for most of my career was because, you know, like the old adage, that's where the money was, right? The bank robbers, the reason cybersecurity mattered to a bank is because you were protecting money, because money had been digitized first. But as everything is digitized, you have a cybersecurity dimension to it, including that of individuals. So I think of it as almost a biological ecosystem, if you will. So each hospital, each family, each government, each small business, public sector division has its own story, its own technology, its own data, and hence its own cybersecurity. But to your question, they do add up to more and more complicated questions. And I think what's most important is not to think of cybersecurity as if you can just, you can solve it technically and then go on with your life. Our lives are too technical and too digital now to not think of cybersecurity and safety as part of the same, part of the same challenge. So take an example, like let's start actually with an individual. Oftentimes identity theft is the experience people have, but that's usually just the first step in a much more complicated set of, think of the bad guys as having an operation. They'll steal money or identity from an individual, but then they'll take control of that computer and then they'll sell access to that computer to some organized criminals who will be aggregating all of these home computers to behave in ways that they will then sell to someone else who wants to take down a website, who wants to mine crypto. And so that then sort of goes even further, and you might then see nation states who are hiring the hackers who broke into these computers and says, you came up with something very clever. Can I buy that? As almost like it's a weapon. I'll pay you for it, and then I use it for my own purposes as a nation state. So I think the important thing is it's all interconnected. And even when you read about identity theft, well, it might seem like just a mugging, you know, in one part of the world. It's all part of that same ecosystem, because on the internet, everyone is connected to everyone else.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I was going to actually get to this later, but I think we should do it now because you've raised it really indirectly, which is, I feel, it seems to me, if you're in traditional national security, you've got your military, and that's part of the Defense Department, and you're worried about its security. You're worried about the nation's security, obviously, against terrorism. So there's civilian aspects of protecting civilian infrastructure as well, and all that. But basically, protecting the security of your nuclear weapons, well, the government has the nuclear weapons, right? So I feel like traditional national security is much more government-centric, let's say, though obviously it's to protect the nation as a whole, not just the, Pentagon or the Congress or whatever. Whereas I do think one of the striking things about cybersecurity is just from your account, and one thinks about it for a second, you could do a huge amount of damage to U.S. national security by taking down the financial system of the U.S., which is 95% in private hands, right? It's not, you could take down the Fed, that would be bad too. But if it's not almost as bad or maybe worse to take down Citibank and Goldman Sachs or whatever and steal, destroy the, you can imagine all the different things one can imagine that people could do. So I mean, does that make it a particular challenge that it's the nation that one has to be hardened against the threats, not just, having good security at the military bases themselves, so to speak, or for the nuclear weapons, wherever they're stored?
Absolutely. And it's the reason back to why I spent most of my time initially in financial services, I felt like that's where the action was, where I could help citizens be safe, was at a bank, because we were running the data center, we were running the website, we were making the money transfer. The same thing is true at Google, and why I've enjoyed this next stage of my career is that cloud computing or Gmail, Gmail has billions of users. So we protect 1.5 billion inboxes from 99.9% of the spam, which includes the malware and the phishing attacks. And you're right, that has nothing to do with the government. It's a purely private sector initiative. Even if you look over in a response to the invasion of Ukraine, for instance, when that occurred, we rolled all of the Ukrainian citizens on Gmail into what we call our advanced protection program, which is sort of a passive behind the scenes heightened security. So while tanks were rolling over the border, they didn't have to worry about, am I going to be the target of a Russian threat actor who is taking advantage of the moment, or an organized criminal? Like you see every time this ambulance chasing occurs too, there's a crisis, people prey on the victims because they send us a phishing email. And so you're absolutely right. A lot of this, some, you know, there was a statistic years ago, 80, 90% of the infrastructure is in private sector hands. There's really no way to calculate such a thing other than to just look around and realize that every hospital, every bank, every ISP, I mean, Google pulls undersea cables, right, with other large technology players between Europe and Africa, between Asia and the US. Those are private sector initiatives and networks.
So this being a free country and a pretty private sector heavy country, which is good, I think, how are we doing? It's such a massive challenge. Then you've got to get, you know, this hospital system and that financial services firm and this university to also, and this local police department and all these people to be attentive to cybersecurity, because it's, it can't just be that people sitting at the Pentagon a few miles from here who are worrying about it, right? So I mean, how does it work in practice, I guess? I would even ask right now in terms of the government and coordination and then we can talk about what the threats are and how much we should be, how much we are doing and whether we're doing enough. But I mean, how does it actually work? Yeah.
It's a complicated question, and let me try and break it into a few segments. But I think the overriding story to remember, there was a paper written by Richard Danzig almost a decade ago at this point, called Surviving on a Diet of Poison Fruit. And it was essentially to bring up to use the experience of human evolution, where we began to be able to eat fruit that had killed our ancestors, because just poison enough or not poisonous enough that you could survive. It wasn't that you needed a perfect world. I think you need to think of the internet as full of poison fruit. But to your question of how we're doing, in a weird way, we're doing really, really well. Like, it's kind of amazing what has happened over the last couple decades. The things that are available, information that is available, even some of the things we were talking about just before this started, the innovations are amazing, and they largely happen safely. And so I think that there is this ecosystem that buffers one risk from another, even though there might be something poisonous about a certain technology, a certain company, a certain attack. But the ecosystem is incredibly powerful. And in fact, that's part of the power of the internet from the very beginning, was to survive physical attacks, let alone technical attacks, was to be so distributed that you couldn't bring it down. This was sort of the origin of DARPA and the internet. So in that way, I think of it as an incredible, story of human innovation that has brought us in all kinds of things. On the other hand, it is wildly federated. And so to your point, the biggest banks, biggest technology providers are pouring literally billions of dollars into keeping these platforms safe. The Gmail, or the cloud computing. But there's still a ton of IT, information technology services, that occur at local levels or in families. And, at that range between Google or a large bank and a small business, there are a lot of stops on the way, and the quality of that is different. So the ransomware attacks that you've seen over the last several years, in many ways, prey on that the folks who are not investing with as much technology. It's not their business, but they have adopted all this technology, and they haven't kept it current. There something is not up to the standard of the kind of world-class attacks that everyone's subjected to. So just as but at the same time, Gmail, cloud computing, is sweeping into those same spaces and saying, don't hire your brother-in-law's friend to maintain those servers under the desk in your printing office in a small town in middle America. Put those on the foundation of a large cloud provider that's maintaining them all the time. And by the way, is defending itself against nation state attackers. So you're a relatively straightforward defensive strategy for them. And all of a sudden they get out of that business and then get on with living their lives productively, convenient. So again, back to this ecosystem, if we can keep that ecosystem open, free, safe, it does solve some of its problems with these innovations.
Interesting. And how well are we doing on the, I guess, the bigger aspects? That is to say, one can imagine a situation where, unfortunately, people are preyed upon by, you know, clever criminals, the way individuals are and stores are and so forth. But, and it's bad and something we should all work to curtail and to limit and to get rid of, but it doesn't pose the national security threat that taking down the financial system or introducing malware that confuses everyone's accounts or that prevents hospitals from functioning or that, to get more immediate, stops DOD from sending the correct orders to people out in the field or communicating among themselves on the battlefield if they're fighting. I mean, it doesn't pose that kind of threat. So on the sort of more national security side of it, are we in pretty good shape? Do we need to be doing much more? Or, I mean, so where are we in that spectrum?
It's a good question. I think the right way to think of it is we need constant investment in the safety of every innovation because it's not static, right? So everything we assume or think that there's a moment where, okay, we've got hospitals, we've got banks, et cetera. But meanwhile, you've got healthcare during the pandemic being delivered to people at home. And all of a sudden you need to think about, well, wait a minute, what about the safety and integrity of home health visits? Not something that had been the focus because that's not the way healthcare had been delivered. So what's really important is that there's a dynamic capability. Two other thoughts that sort of extend that. Cybersecurity is defined by having an active adversary. So it's not just that there's this list of things that could go wrong. And for every new technology, you say, okay, did we do A, B, C, D? Behind the attackers are, innovators and, interconnected organized crime or nation state spies who are thinking every time there's an innovation, how could I abuse that? And so it's, I like to think of the old Mike Tyson comment that everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. And so we want to think of it. Yes, we're in a reasonably good state in many ways, but that changes the next second, the next minute, if we don't stay ahead of what the adversary is going to attempt. So that's one. The other is the complexity does provide a certain set of or some comfort or some safety. I worked in a bank for a long time, one of the banks where the CIO said to me, I wouldn't know how to steal money from this bank. And by that, he didn't mean intellectually. He just literally mean he couldn't have sat down at the computer and without anybody knowing, written scripts and done things to transfer money. Like, banks are complicated entities, and so is society. So I think sometimes we're lulled into thinking that, okay, it's a ransomware attack or it's stealing some information of a small business. But I do think we need to keep worrying about the most sophisticated attackers doing the kind of things you described. But that's a real escalation to take down a financial services industry or to take, sort of a stock exchange. It's not to say those things aren't possible, but they are very complex, and they're not something that one individual in a basement is going to be able to do. And so really, I think of it as keeping pace with the innovations in each of these sectors. You need the safety of those to keep pace, or we fall behind very quickly.
And there's an obvious kind of public choice, I guess we'd call it, in economics or political economy problem of you're depending on private sector, Chase Bank or Citibank or whoever to invest appropriately and to upgrade appropriately. But that comes from that's their money, so to speak. They're spending on it out of their revenues. And so unlike, again, if the federal government taxes us all to spend money on the military, well, that's the pool of money that is expected to be spent on that. How much do you feel like in general, the private sector, civil society, whatever, I mean, I don't know, maybe we do require them to do more. I don't know how the laws work, but do you feel people are doing most of what they should be doing? Or is it a real problem that people are always thinking, why should I be spending an extra large sum of money on this. I guess in some cases they have they have their own incentives, right? You don't want to be the bank that gets the reputation of having its customers' money stolen a lot. But some of these things are not visible or not, they're longer term, right? I mean, you wouldn't know that people had underinvested until disaster happens.
And again, I think it varies widely. I think you've got lots and lots of individuals and small businesses and companies up to reasonable size who struggle to keep pace with the innovation, for sure. Right. I think you're right at the big institutions that sort of where they spend billions of dollars on technology. This has become a board level issue. And it's actually one of the, I think, the ways in which this continues to get better. But they're all regulation, you touched briefly on it. You know, at a bank, cybersecurity is a form of examination in the broader regulatory framework.
Interesting.
And so each sector has added cybersecurity or other technology related exams or standards as the banks or the entities they regulate have digitized. So, you know, I think in a way that system has worked reasonably well. Now, the question is what things are common and should be done in maybe one standard way versus things that are unique to healthcare or finance or telecommunications. So I think there's healthy dialogue and in sort of open and free, you know, countries about how to get that right. But it's still an open question about the right balance. But that they are in those, you know, people are in those spaces.
And I guess it's not as if these things are confined by country. As you're speaking, I'm thinking they're not confined by national borders either, right? I mean, if we're interconnected, obviously there are financial transfers flowing all the time between branches of institutions of different nations or institutions of different nations or national banks, for that matter, if you want to explain the financial side. And so if Great Britain goes down, we're in a lot of trouble here. I mean, so I suppose there's that kind of public choice, sort of more like a NATO alliance problem of everyone has to invest enough to make sure the alliance as a whole is strong enough. But the alliance here is kind of almost everyone, right?
That's right. So I think that, you know, I was thinking back to the one of the earlier questions on infrastructure. What is a nation in cyberspace? Right? It's not an obvious answer. Is it the corporations and the technology? Is it the data of the citizens? You know, a lot of these questions are being worked out. What does an individual expect? What does a corporation expect? What does a government expect? And so you're absolutely right. We are, as a company, because we're a global company, we have relationships where we talk about infrastructure with companies all over the globe. And I think it's incredibly important that we continue to keep that open and safe, because you will see some countries try to impose their view of the internet for their country in ways that break up the conveniences, the freedoms, the safety of this interconnected infrastructure. So it takes some sophistication and thoughtfulness to not break those things, because the technology is complicated as you go down the stack.
And I guess I'll try to ask this question in the right way. And I'm obviously you'll answer using publicly available data and so forth and not proprietary or national security stuff. But I mean, how much are we talking about, you know, sort of bands of robbers, some of them very tech savvy, or even parts of nation states kind of causing a lot of trouble, let's just say, which could be, you know, deadly trouble if a hospital system goes down or if it messes up our internal DoD communications or whatever. But still, you know, sort of trouble, bad trouble, ranging all the way to actual niche, big-ish or well, whether they're big or not, but strong nation states, or strong in this area nation states, really building up offensive capabilities that could fundamentally, you know, be in effect an act of war as other kinds of offensive capabilities give them the opportunity to launch an attack. I mean, is it more the first or is it all the way to the second?
Yeah, it's all of the above with, again, that same division. So you have large players who you would expect, given their budgets and size and complexity, to be operating, you know, at levels that should be considered offensive in the way a war could be. And look, they're already used as part of hybrid operations, right? It doesn't always have to be, again, this isn't cyber as a completely separate domain. You would always see heavy coordination between the cyber part of a government and its military during a war. That, you know, we already see that. But the you were on the question of just thinking back to your where you were on the
yeah, just sort of how much of it is. Are we thinking, you know, are we deterring small countries from doing damage
right.
in small ways, or are we deterring, you know, the Soviet Union from, you know, from attacking us? I mean, what's the sort of reality out there?
On the great powers view, there are the people you would expect, the sort of the great powers, the sort of large companies. But what's interesting about this space is you and we have a couple of good examples which we could share recently where we see corporations, small corporations, in jurisdictions where they can operate with some freedom, developing weapons and selling those weapons, these cyber weapons, to smaller governments who can't invest the way the large players can, so that they have capabilities that begin to look like the largest players. So again, the continuum develops and an ecosystem develops around it. Again, it's almost as if it was a technology project, right? A technology project. You got to go have expertise who know how to break into things and then share information. That whole ecosystem exists. And you see a lot of people who live between the worlds. They make some money working for organized crime, and they may sell on their services to a nation state through a series of transactions as well. So the lines are very blurry, but everyone is trying to be a player in this space.
Yeah, I guess this makes me think of, I think the military historians will often say that there are periods where the offense is dominant and then the defense kind of catches up, and then you have trench warfare for, you know, 50 years or something like that. And then there's a breakthrough, the tank, and the offense takes over again. And obviously we've seen that in the air and so forth. Is it clear does that even make sense in talking about this area and cybersecurity? And have there been such sort of oscillations, and are we in a particular moment right now?
It does. And I think, you know, as you go back to the birth of the internet, when you first, most PCs, most, you know, personal computers were developed to be personal computers. So the computational powers and the storage swept in but would never contemplated the idea that they would be exposed to nation state attackers. They were just in your living room. The moment those started to be interconnected and this explosion of sort of personal services or corporate services on the internet, I do think you see a bit of a frontier moment where everyone's working out how to do the innovation, but also how to attack. I think we're also now seeing, though, you know, if that's the world we've been living in, cloud computing is in a way a return to the original computers, right? The original computers were these giant computers in warehouses where they could be cooled, and you would get time shared on them, or you'd maybe be connected to them, and you'd get a little slice of the computational power. You might even submit your punch cards and then you'd get them back. And so you were sharing that. But the beauty is, you didn't have to maintain the ENIAC's patch level. That's not what an individual did. Cloud computing is this sort of unusual moment where all of that low-level infrastructure, storage, computational capabilities, networks, increasingly sophisticated capabilities, you don't have to have an IT shop. You don't have to have a personal computer to do it. You can outsource that, in a sense. You outsource the security of it to big cloud providers. And the beauty of it is that that's not a security project. That's an economic and innovation project. So I think that the good news is we're at a unique moment, to your point about where we are in the history, where the innovation and the security are the same efforts. So if we're smart about this, and we invest in ways that sort of have this continually updating security, we actually set ourselves up very nicely for the future. If we keep working where every company and every person has to do everything themselves, we're already lost. You know, we've already lost is the truth.
That's so interesting about it. I hadn't really thought about cloud computing in that way. I don't know much about it anyway, but I mean, I sort of had this vague, you know, there's the internet and then there's a whole set of new challenges. But of course, when you think, I mean, I think it's very good the way you explained it, that yes, there'll be moments where the internet works in a way that's friendlier, as it were, to security or against, helps the defense, maybe is a good, if the defense is intelligent.
That's right.
As opposed to the offense. I guess the other thing military historians, just to go down that parallel one, for one more example, is we'll say, I think, is that there are times when being bigger, wealthier, bigger nation, either landmass or in industrial capacity, gives you a massive advantage. I mean, if you're the US and you can produce, a plane every, a fighter plane every day, you're going to ultimately be in decent, you know, if you're fighting a big world war, that's a good thing to be in, similar with landmass and sort of older times, right? If you're Russia,
right,
in 1812 or something. But there are other times and other technological advances that tend to level that playing field some, right? I mean, drones, I guess, as opposed to producing massive, complex, F-35s. And so does that analogy also work here a little bit? I mean, with
it does, and in good and bad ways, both, to your point. In the nuclear comparison, you need nuclear scientists and you need incredibly sophisticated machinery to enrich uranium or what, you know, I'm not at all versed in this, but I know enough to know that I don't know. But in cybersecurity, back to this point of selling weapons between groups, it's kind of copy-paste.
Yeah.
Right. If you can copy and paste the text that is the code or that is the vulnerability or the way you exploit the vulnerability, you can sell that to anyone. And so it does, I don't know, democratize maybe the wrong word, but it certainly levels the playing field. Everyone can play some role in this. You know, it's often surprising when you see these attacks and they haul some teenager out of the basement who, you know, right, who's living with his mom. Hmm. Right. It's not what you think. So there's definitely, you know, that element of it. It is why, and you'll let me sort of, you know, talk about this for a second, is that
please,
it's why the infrastructure and the investment as a country or a sort of an open society is so important. Because it, you know, there is an element in, there is a dimension in which this has made it easier for small players to cause trouble in broadly in society. In the same way that small players can help, you know, that, you know, a small company can provide an incredible innovation. It also works in reverse. So it matters a lot who is building the networks, running those cloud computers, and who can keep the platform safe. Because we rely on this continual baking in of security and safety. If we were left to run on everybody's home computer, sort of by proxy, the variation would be way too great to keep safe and secure. You'd be back to that surviving on a diet of poison fruit. The eventually that poison would kill you. But if you build capabilities that allow us to kind of survive with some tolerance for the messiness, for that, you know, copy paste attack, takes away whole classes of vulnerabilities, right? No one's maintaining a server anymore. No one's maintaining an email server. Then you've eliminated a lot of the low-hanging fruit for these bad actors, and you make them be more sophisticated than the banking system. You know, that CIO who can't steal money, even if somebody can hack into one computer, can they steal money from the bank? Can they manipulate the data in a hospital? It's a much more sophisticated problem if you've invested in the infrastructure.
And if I understand you, I think what you're saying also is that if you, again, use the military analogy, that, you know, in the after 9/11, we spent a lot of time learning how to fight counterterrorism, and that was very pretty small unit focused, and General Petraeus did in Iraq and so forth. And then everyone decided, in, you know, but 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, oh, that's okay. That's sort of under control. And anyway, we're not course, we're not, U.S. isn't really engaged on the ground in the Middle East, but China. So now we have to go to the other extreme and worry about, you know, genuine great power competition. And of course, the military and the government does both. It has to do both because you don't know exactly. You do have both threats. But you're saying that it's really sounds to me like it's a pretty full spectrum, right? That you can't sort of downgrade one side of this challenge or another. I mean, partly because I think of I don't know what the right word is. There's not a strong barrier between one or the other, and quite as much as there is maybe in the real world. Either you're a big nation or you're not. If you're not a big nation, you can do terrorism, terrible, but you can't do certain things. And if you are a big nation, there are probably other things you'll focus on in terms of your taking advantage of your enemies. But here, it seems like it's more of a continuum.
It's definitely more of a continuum. And just last week, I was in Washington, D.C. with and the digital minister of Ukraine was in the U.S. for a variety of meetings. And it was interesting to hear them talk about how important it was not just to be safe and secure, but to make the Ukrainian government IT services and the way Ukrainian businesses operated take a step function forward in the innovation and the capabilities. So even, you know, countries that are, you know, being attacked or in a war are thinking about their technical capabilities, not just through the safety lens, but how do they get ahead of these technical risks? So I was surprised to the degree that they were that forward thinking about technology, even in the kind of civil society, not just the military sense, is incredibly important for their future. That to me is indicative of it. Yeah.
I mean, speaking of Ukraine, what lessons do you take from that? That is to say, I remember when in February, when the invasion was imminent and people were wondering about it, there was a lot of talk about it. Russia's seems to be pretty both advanced and aggressive in the cyber space. So will they take down the Ukrainian system or take down our connections, even to Ukraine conceivably, or an escalation, obviously. And what lessons so there they are, they invaded and it's brutal and a big land war in Europe, biggest one since 45. What lessons are there on the cybersecurity front, would you say, generally speaking, in the almost years since that's been going?
That's right. So the first is that cyber war began in 2014 with the annexation of Crimea. So you can operate in kind of an asynchronous or less obvious way. And attacks, many of the biggest attacks we know of in the last 8 years, have their origins in Russian threat actors attacking something in their Ukraine. Hmm. And we saw a step up in that set of attacks, but it was, again, a continuum, not as if at the first time someone was trying to attack in the Ukrainian systems. So that's the first one. The second is, and I talked a little bit about Gmail accounts in Ukraine and how people's personal computing and small businesses computing matters enormously to their lives. It's not like these were luxuries that they still, that they could put aside while there was a war. So for instance, you know, one of the things we did was we took the protections that we put in front of search or our largest apps to keep them up against any kind of attack. And we had designed them to be deployed to small entities, so news sources or philanthropic or, you know, refugee websites that began to be attacked to take them offline. And so we put that called Project Shield in front of these small businesses. What was amazing is how quickly all of this happened. So the Gmail protections happened sort of overnight. These Project Shield putting in front of websites that citizens needed happened over the course of days and weeks. Mm-hmm. Because they were available, like we talked about before, in these large technology or other services. So, the Ukrainian defenses had been practiced for many, many years on this front. And B, we have options. I've heard on your podcast several times how important it is to have options. It's not to have every plan worked out, but it's to have options depending on what happens. And I think in this case, you saw Ukraine take advantage of a lot of those technology options. And that's a large part of why they've done well. I think the other thing to remember is the sophistication required to perform a really sophisticated, you know, sort of really complicated attack takes a whole lot of planning and operational planning as well, which is to say it will or won't happen, but that's not a button that somebody's waiting to push. Just like invading a certain part of Ukraine takes a whole lot of operational planning, so does a really sophisticated attack. So I still worry that those could happen, but I think they do, you know, it's an escalation and it's a level of complexity that is different than just saying, let's take down some websites or let's take over some Gmail accounts, you know, let's attack someone.
Yeah, that's interesting. But I suppose deterrence works too. That is to say, if one were advising Putin, I mean, God forbid, but whatever, you know, and it's say, look, NATO's doing all this stuff. I mean, can't we disrupt NATO's internal coordination or communications or US-Ukraine, you know, connections? But I suppose at that point, you do have the somewhat normal, you know, in international relations, deterrence and the threat of retaliation, or does that work too in cybersecurity?
Yeah, I think it certainly does. It's not the world I really live in, but it is, that's my sense, is that, you know, so the capabilities, anything you can imagine you can do, you have to assume others can do. I mean, that's the other thing that sometimes we think in this world that the vulnerabilities or the problems we have, we could keep secret. And I think given that sort of copy-paste nature of what we're doing, you have to assume that any problem you have or any vulnerability you have is going to be made known, and you need to defend against it rather than pretending you can keep it secret.
And when you say, when you come to Washington, but I wouldn't even make it that specific, but if you come to Washington, I mean, how much, well, leave that aside. If you were briefing people in the executive branch or Congress, I guess, what would be your top two or three things they should worry about that maybe, you know, what would you say? Look, you know what, this is in pretty good shape. Just keep funding it the way you are, or keep the current legislative or regulatory structure in place. And what two or three things, when you do come here, do you tend to say, if this really needs some more work?
Yeah, so I think the first is that making sure the country's technology is secure by design or by default is the only way we're going to tackle this problem, right? So back to my cloud computing example and modernization, if what we're going to try and do is you know, patch or protect every personal computer and every mobile phone and every server and every network in the country, it's not a scalable problem. That changes tomorrow, let alone the scale. So we have to invest and adopt modern technology platforms that, you know, it's just like an infrastructure project in a way, right? You got to keep a modern infrastructure if you want to run a safe, open society. So that's sort of the first one. The second is the workforce. And we spend a lot of time thinking about how do we bring citizens across the country into this world? Not everyone's going to become a hacker. Not everyone's going to become a software developer. But increasingly, people are actors in this space. You know, the choices they make about data, the choices they make about technology providers matter a lot. And so we think about the sort of digital literacy work and how do we bring more citizens along, all the way to how do we hire people into jobs where they can be productive in the private sector or public sector, but private sector is every bit as important as a cybersecurity person. I mean, that, you know, demystify that. Make it a job, make it a career. So I think the second piece we talk about a lot is workforce. How do we develop the citizens? And then the third is that, we alluded to it a little bit along the way, but the infrastructure, just like the banks, if you think back to the world runs on large financial services institutions, you know, largely a dollar reserve currency. At the moment, that the world runs on Western open sort of technology infrastructure. But that's not a foregone conclusion. A lot of this technology is still being built out. And it's important for an open and free society, which we, you know, the US is built on and relies on in that interconnected way, that the foundations, that everything from the networks, to the hardware, to the software and the data, be running on rails in a railroad analogy, or undersea cables that are provided by companies that support those same open and free ideologies. And so I think that's the third one, is that this is not just another market. We're laying down the infrastructure for the 21st century. And that's, it's not all done. It's not over.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And maybe we can kind of close with that set of reflections on that, because on the one hand, it's so globalized and so international, and I assume it would be somewhat self-destructive to be cutting off trade or not using minerals from all over the world and so forth, and selling stuff all over the world. On the other hand, as you say, you don't want, it can't simply be sort of care that reasonable governments and friendly governments are somehow have control of the core enough of the core infrastructure to make sure things don't go wrong. How much of a tension is that, and do you feel like we're doing a decent job of handling that?
I think we've done a decent job, and maybe even a very good job to date, and in large part because we've followed the innovations and kind of investments and conveniences of the internet age. But I do think your points are correct, and I look to the political landscape a bit for lessons, that we're not saying that one safe set of technologies is the only way to survive. That would defeat the purpose of this interconnect and letting people innovate and share. So I think there's a tension that we need to use society's kind of, open and free society's capabilities to keep finding that balance of safe, secure infrastructure, but still allows it to plug in to innovative and new offerings. And I don't think that's a destination. That's an ongoing process. But what you can't do is lose that lower level foundation, because you lose control of everything above it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I'm just struck so much of the public discourse, the last few years especially, obviously, has been so hostile to big tech, and from left and right, really. Used to be a little more the left back 10 years ago, and now both sides. And with no apparent recognition that some of the things they complain about, they may well be right to complain about, and some of the things are legitimate debates and, real issues of sensible regulation and where to draw lines, free speech, a lot of very complex issues, obviously. But at the end of the day, we really should be happy. I think I'm right about this, right? That these big tech companies are mostly here, to be sort of parochial here and kind of like American, patriot or nationalist or something here, or just kind of chauvinist. I mean, it's good that the people here either invented these things or were able to get the capital to develop them when they were invented abroad. I'm sure many were, the individual inventors are not necessarily all by any means American. And that these companies are headquartered here and susceptible to U.S. laws and regulations. And obviously they employ people from all over the world, and that's good, in my opinion. But that a certain number of the key people making decisions are U.S. citizens. I mean, the nation state doesn't go away, right? But I am struck how little kind of sense is that that's a pretty big asset of the United States of America going forward in the 21st century. Right. I mean, and it needn't be. It's not only just that these companies could be in China and Russia, and I guess China is a more interesting kind of obvious competitor right now, but they could also be scattered all over the place. And that would itself be, it's very lucky in a way that we had this, we were the heart of the tech boom for various reasons. I don't know.
It's why we up and moved the family from New York to California, because to work in that question felt to me like the most important thing a cybersecurity person can do, right? If you're talking about laying down the digital and technical kind of data-driven infrastructure of the 21st century in a safe way, where else would you do that? And it would be, to me, it would be a tragedy to lose that asset and that sort of underpinning that we all benefit from in this sort of open and safe internet.
But I think your point here is that it's not like, well, okay, we established that railroad lines. Once they're built, you don't have to worry too much about being the place that railroad engineers want to work for the next 50 years. You need to have enough people to repair them or upgrade them. I mean, it's probably good to have new ones occasionally, but leaving that aside, in some sense, it's much more of a, you can afford a lull in other areas of industrial development. Let's put it that way. And
I think that's fair. There are standards,
right?
Yeah, there are standards and capabilities which are being laid down for the first time in many cases here. And they will last for a long time.
But also the character of the internet, as you've been saying, is that it's always changing too. So that you can't just relax and say, well, let the Chinese have the next 20 or 30 years. That would not work out well.
That's right. That's exactly right. I mean, think of the debates about 5G, 6G. There are a few examples of this debate. I think, though, that this debate extends into the very mundane, you know, just compute network, you know, data centers.
And if there were one or two things you would say people really just don't see that they should see, or, I mean, be aware of, even if they're not going to become experts on people who are watching this or whatever, what would you sort of urge them to, you know, to educate themselves about a little bit more? You can mention particular books or websites if you want, but I'm just generally speaking, you know, what is it that people don't know that they should know? Or I guess, what are their myths they believe that maybe they should be disabused of?
Yeah, I think the first is, and just sort of speaking even more personally, that your digital identity and your ability to authenticate with a website, with your email, like just in terms of keeping yourself and your family safe, implementing what we call two-factor authentication, where you get that code or you have another means of authenticating. It's one of these step functions. It makes you so much safer. So that's the first thing. The second is, I think the supply chain of technology and the supply chain of data, I think is an area people can look more closely at. And I don't think it requires, you know, you don't have to understand exactly how everything's done, but where does this software that you run on come from? It's a supply chain and it's sort of cobbled together at multiple layers. And same with the data. Where is the data managed and where does it go? And I think there's an interesting, you know, there's business policy, understanding better the supply chain. And we have some, you know, I could pass along some papers on this and the associated data supply chain. To me, those are human, societal, political questions, not just the technical implementation. You don't actually need to understand the firmware, but you can figure out, well, where is the code coming from and what's the quality and security of that? What's the safety of the data? And that to me is, you know, industry specific, person specific, policy specific. People can do that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And in terms of the threats, you know, during the Cold War, there were always these, oh, you hawks are making the Soviet Union 10 feet tall. And then the hawks would say, you know, they're stronger than you think, just because they're behind in some consumer goods doesn't mean that their weapons don't work as well as ours and stuff. I mean, to the degree you can discuss, I mean, how much are we in peer-to-peer situation? How much are we a million miles ahead and we're just, you know, have to just make sure we stay ahead? I assume it's somewhere between, but I mean, what's the truth about that? And
the good news is, you know, that same investment in technology that we talked about and sort of the strength of the of sort of US or Western or others, or the friends in this space are very good in this area. The other thing, though, to keep in mind is the asynchronous nature of it. You don't need a lot of people. This is not the nuclear analogy. Like small numbers of individuals can be bad actors, and maybe they can't pull off the taking down the entire grid, but they can, as we've seen, you know, real critical businesses have been subjected to ransomware attacks that were not necessarily performed by the most sophisticated actors in the world. And if you just extrapolate from that, the most sophisticated actors could do much more. So I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer there, in that you really aren't ever safe, because the adversary is innovating, and the adversary could be a small number of people. So it's almost less about country to country and more about keeping the ecosystem safe.
So I suppose if this is a big country that's kind of hostile and has some territorial ambitions and has a well-educated large population of which they can draw very capable people, that is a real threat, right? I mean, China is maybe a little bit unique almost in sort of being...
You know, we often talk about Russia, China, North Korea, Iran as being very active in this area. But I think even to that point, you know, Iran and North Korea don't, you know, look nothing like China. But that doesn't, you know, they're countries investing this kind of capability. So I don't, those are typical countries though you would hear people talk about.
Yeah, of course, though they can exchange, just as with weapons and with nuclear programs, as we know, Pakistan is not, you know, doesn't have, is not as advanced a country as others, but guess what? They have a nuclear program because they were helped by others. And so I suppose there's that question too of then the other guy, the bad guys can cooperate some, both as states, but also, you know, criminal groups almost, right? So
that's exactly right. I mean, this is back to this, and there's been a lot of attention on this year, and we even testified in Europe on this front, that that this ecosystem of companies who are selling those weapons into second or third tier or size states to a sort of prop up their capabilities is a real problem.
Interesting. Last words, stuff that we didn't cover that we should discuss or that people need to know about, or again, feel free to disabuse us of any myths that we might believe in. You know?
No, I think the two things are one, this, you know, laying down the infrastructure for the 21st century, super important. And then the second is, and back to this data and the supply chain, it isn't as, you know, magical or mystical as maybe we want to think of it. It's all grounded in the, you know, everywhere you can think of an innovation of a new website that does something creative to help people. That's what we're talking about on the other side. Some bad actor is saying, oh, how do I take these technologies and combine them in a bad way? And so it's not, it isn't like, you know, it's not magic and it's not space travel in that sense. This is just people using the innovations against us. And that sort of, I think, makes it more natural for a regular person to think, okay, well, wait a minute, how could this be used against me? It's a neat website or this is a neat app, but this could also be used in the wrong way.
Now, I think that's very important because I myself, not being very techy, tend to think as, oh, it's such a, you know, it's sort of both the Wild West and extremely sophisticated technologically and scientifically. And therefore, how could one even think to follow or track, if you want to put it this way, the supply chain of bad actors and see where one could intervene. But I guess what you're saying is that it's a little more like other, if you want your poison to get back to your poison fruit, if people are poisoning fruit, there sometimes it's hard to find who did it. And, you know, that's, if you're very clever, you can disguise maybe where you are when you do it, but there are ways to track such people down.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we choose the websites we use, we start to choose the apps and, you know, the habits we build. It is worth understanding more about where that software, the data is coming or going. I think that's the other. So it's not, I think we sometimes, you know, because of that fear of the complexity, people assume that they have no role in making some of those decisions. And I think people increasingly can make those decisions and participate in the, where is that software coming from? Where is that data? Who is this company, this website that I'm using to help run my family schedule on?
Interesting. That's terrific. Well, Royal, thanks so much for taking the time to educate us and a lot of to think about here. And but I really feel that I understand the playing field a little better, and the challenges are real though. And I guess that's my main takeaway. That one of my takeaways is, yeah, you can't just solve it and then wash your hands and say, okay, well, security's done. Now we can go back to something else, right? I mean, this is much more than even normal situations where you can't, of course, wash your hands. You need a police force 24/7 and so forth, even if crime is down. But here it really is, you know, the bad guys aren't resting and things keep innovating and changing and the dangers are real, right? That's the other thing, I guess, one should just maybe stress. I mean, one's own personal experience of this is so much annoyance or inconvenience. Mm-hmm. You know, my credit, I have to get a new credit card because someone, you know, got the number and luckily they reimbursed me. So it's not that inconvenient. I mean, there are more serious versions of this, of course, but you are talking about fundamental threats, not just inconveniences.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's very well said. And again, as you think about the areas of society and life that depend on the quality of the data, those are big questions. Those aren't just conveniences anymore. Yeah. Those are our lives.
It's not just not being able to get tickets to, what's your name, Taylor Swift's concerts because of whatever, Ticketmaster.
Exactly.
That was a big topic of conversation. As you can tell, I'm kind of clueless. It took me a while to find out what they were talking about. It's very recently, but
that's good. No, healthcare, travel, logistics. I mean, everything is underpinned by this at this point.
So. Yeah, the way everything working and production of food, actual fundamentals of survival and well-being. Yeah. Royal, thank you very much for joining me today and taking the time. It's really, really enlightening and interesting conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining us on Conversations.